Thank you. Well, we began actually quite a number of hours ago now this morning. We began with beginnings. In the beginning was Homer. And that's the beginning of the story of classical Greece. And now I'd like to close this long morning session with another beginning, another set of beginnings, if you like. We're now in the early 19th century, the beginning of modernity, and the particular focus of this paper, the beginning of what we call modern Greece. I want to focus, my written paper focuses very largely on two foreign protagonists, supporters of the struggle for modern Greek independence, the poets Percy Bysshe Shelley and Lord Byron. Just now, as time is rather short, I'm going to say a little bit less about that and focus more on the last part of the paper and on some of its implications for, I think, the general dialogues in which we find ourselves here today. But first of all, to summarize the points I wanted to make about Byron and about Shelley. Byron's Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, published the first two counters of it, published in 1812, popularized a view of Greece as not merely a site of classical splendor, but of a downtrodden present and a problematic future. Greece wasn't just past, it was present and future. And this new focus for interest in Greece quickly found its place in the emerging and closely interlinked ideologies of romanticism in the arts and of liberalism and nationalism in politics. Now, when it was published in March 1812, the first two counters of Byron's poem, Childe Harold, was a runaway success. And it created Byron, many people have said, since as the first modern celebrity. A consequence of that commercial public success of Byron's poetic version of Greece was that what Byron reported and thought about Greece was read by many more readers than all the travel books of the time taken together. Childe Harold in the original, its translations into many European languages, and the cult of the celebrity that, as I said, really began with Byron, all ensured that from 1812 onwards, Greece entered the consciousness of Western Europe as a living landscape inhabited by contemporary people, and that the political future of those people in 1812 was something beginning to be recognized as a problem to be confronted, not just here on the ground in Greece, but also by Western Europeans, a problem for the future. The point I'm getting at really in all of this is that Greece, from becoming the ruins of the past, from being a paradigm of the perfection of an ancient civilization, Greece becomes a contemporary living problem and a set of projections, hopes, fears, ideals, as we'll see, for the future. Now, that was in 1812, and when he published those first counters of Childe Harold, Byron was actually, let's be honest, he was no great Philhellene. In the notes he published to those cantos, he said that he didn't think Greece ever could be, or indeed should be, independent. He was aware of stirrings of thoughts, of aspirations for national independence, and he rather poo-pooed them. He was rather critical. We'll come back to Byron and Greece in a moment. But all of this changed in February and March 1821. As you know, Toikos Siena, 1821, the uprising that led to Greek independence. Now, in English literature, the first poet to devote a major poem, both in terms of its length and of its recognized poetic stature, was actually not the more famous Byron, but his friend, the slightly younger, Percy Bysshe Shelley. We heard yesterday about Aeschylus' play, The Persians, and how that play was written and performed 8 years after the Battle of Salamis, and imaginatively projected the victory of the Greeks and the values for which they fought into the dialogically imagined plight of the losers. Now, Shelley, living in Pisa in Italy, in October 1821, came up with the marvelous idea of rewriting Aeschylus's play in modern romantic terms. So Hellas, as he called his play, is set not in the Oriental court of Oriental luxury of the Persian capital, Susa, it's set in the Ottoman capital, Istanbul, Constantinople. The role of Xerxes is taken by Mahmud. The ghost is not Darius, the father of Xerxes, but Mehmed the Conqueror, of whom we heard from Professor Coder a few minutes ago. But we heard yesterday also that Aeschylus was pretty brave, it was in all senses a dramatic move, that very first surviving ancient Greek tragedy written only 8 years after the victory. But look at what Shelley was doing. He was writing before, actually in the month when the Greeks captured Tripolitsa, the first major victory of the War of Independence. The outcome of that struggle was by no means a foregone conclusion. And indeed, Shelley makes a rather interesting move in his poem. You expect that following the Persians, Mahmud is going to learn that it's all over, the Greeks have won, and the whole story is going to end in lamentation and tragedy. Not a bit of it. In Shelley's poem, it's the Ottomans who win. Shelley didn't have that confidence. He wasn't able to foresee the literal historical truth of what was going to follow. Shelley makes a very interesting move in this poem. He makes the chorus of Greek captive women say this: Greece is built below the tide of war in the crystalline sea of thought. For Shelley, Greece, and he means ancient Greece, actually stands outside history altogether. The survival and the future of Greece, therefore, does not depend on historical contingency. It lives eternally out of time, a resource available to all human beings at any time. And it is, I think, in that sense that Shelley famously wrote in his preface to Hellas, we are all Greeks, a resounding call, of course, to Philhellenism at the time. So that was one way in which Shelley perceived Greece as something eternal, standing outside time, outside the confines of history. But he also made, in the preface, he made what is perhaps an even more radical move. He referred to the modern Greeks struggling for their independence as the descendants of a nation. Now, this makes Shelley one of the first people, at least in English, to ascribe the then emerging term of the nation to the ancient Greeks. And because he did that, he then argued that we modern Europeans owe a debt to ancient Greece, which falls due in the present. Therefore, modern Europe owes a debt to the modern Greeks fighting to restore the civilization of their ancient forebears. It's a very powerful argument that has resounded down the centuries and really lies at the foundation of the modern Greek nation state. Now, I'm going to come back to Byron and move on in time, because, again, perhaps curiously, in 1821, Byron, who had made his name partly writing about Greece, really kept his head down about the Greek War of Independence. He didn't make public statements about it. He made very few private statements. It's hard to make out, indeed, what Byron really thought about events in Greece in 1821 and even in 1822. It was only after the death of his friend Shelley, in a boating accident in July 1822, that Byron seriously began to think about the Greek Revolution and taking part in it himself. Now, Byron, when he did come to take an interest in Greece, Byron didn't idealize ancient Greece as Shelley had done. What he saw in revolutionary Greece was not so much the perennial ideal of an ancient civilization, but rather the new idea of an entirely new kind of society, a new kind of politics. He saw in Greece the emergence of what we today call a nation-state. And I think he doesn't really make this explicit, but I think this is what Byron meant when in so many of his letters from Kefalonia and from Missolonghi in the last months of his life, he wrote about the struggle for Greek independence as what he called the cause, with a capital C. The cause, I think, was not so much the restoration of ancient Greek civilization. It was not, or was not only, his admiration for the modern Greeks alongside whom he was prepared to fight. It was the idea of this new kind of polity, what we, as I say, call the nation state. And in this way, Byron really crowned his career by moving from romantic poetics to the culmination of those poetics converted into political action, the fight on the ground to create this new political entity, a state. So Greece, as Byron sees it in the last months of his life, is no longer ancient. Greece becomes a cause, in inverted commas, with a capital letter, a cause literally to die for, a cause in the modern world, and a cause that defines the modern world. Now, I think time is rather against me, so I'm going to sum up the last part of this. But yes, I think the point I want to make, the final point perhaps to make, is that Byron's contribution to the War of Independence was primarily a political one, not a military one. You know, there are the famous pictures of the pseudo-Homeric helmets that he had devised in Genoa. He came ashore at Missolonghi, apparently in military uniform. He was given command of a body of Suliots, and he was going to lead an attack on the fortress of Lepanto, modern Navpactos. But none of that happened. And it's probably just as well that it never happened, because Byron wasn't cut out for that kind of thing. But what Byron did do was he contributed to the political outcome of the War of Independence in the creation of a modern Greek nation-state. And part of his commitment, what he encouraged the Greeks alongside whom he fought to do, was to internationalize their conflict. And we know that that succeeded, because the crucial action that really sealed the end of the Greek War of Independence, that assured that Greece would become a free and independent nation, was the Battle of Navarino on 20th October 1827, in which no Greeks and no Turks took part. It was fought between the navies of Britain, France, and Russia on one side, and Egypt on the other. And that victory was sealed in a diplomatic protocol dated 3rd of February 1830, the London Protocol as it's ever been known ever since. And I think it's a great shame, it's a remarkable fact, that this date of 3rd of February 1830, it should, I believe, be as famous in Greek history as the 25th of March 1821. But nobody, I think, really knows it or thinks about it particularly. In that protocol, the signatories of the three powers, Britain, France, and Russia, agreed this. I quote in translation, "Greece will form an independent state and will enjoy all the political, administrative, and commercial rights attached to total independence." Now, we can worry or we can quibble about what that independence meant in fact. It certainly had a downside. Internationalization did mean that ever since, and indeed still today, foreign powers have a say in how the Greek state is run and what it does. You don't need me to remind you of the mnemonio, the memorandum. That also is a consequence of the internationalization of the Greek struggle way back in the 1820s. But what that struggle did achieve was to establish Greece as the first ever new nation-state in Europe. I would go further. I would suggest that the Greek Revolution was the first wholly successful revolution on European soil. Apologies to our French colleagues present, but the French Revolution didn't immediately succeed in all its aims. And it's perhaps a matter of historical discussion when it did, or will. But the Greek Revolution begun in 1821, the military seal is set in 1827, the diplomatic seal in February 1830. And in 1830, Greece becomes a nation state a year before Belgium. Again, with apologies, a nation state which is in the news at the moment. It has constitutional problems. But Belgium was established in 1831, Switzerland 1847, Italy 1861, Germany 1871. The list goes on, Kosovo 2008, and by Legondas. Greece is right at the beginning, the first of those nation states. And that's the beginning that, as we end this session, I'd like to leave you with. Thank you.